Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Last Word on Tennis podcast. Obviously coming to you without tennis, unfortunately, still at the moment with the coronavirus situation spreading as it is throughout the world, and there's far more important things to talk about than live tennis. But we do have a couple of announcements kind of as that's kind of grown, and more tournaments have obviously said that they will not be participating in the tennis calendar this year, and we're all wondering when the tennis is going to be coming back. But we'll have a little bit of chat about that, but that's not the main thrust of this podcast. I've got a special guest with us today, someone that I know kind of personally, but has been around the tennis scene for quite a while now, about 8 years, 8 to 10 years. We're going to be speaking to Rob Heath today. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you doing? I think 11 years, 10 properly.
Yeah, I obviously spoke to you earlier in the week, and I was trying to rack my brains there as to how many years you actually kind of said about. But yeah, 11 years kind of coming up. So one quick question just to introduce you into the podcast. I always like to introduce our guests with a bit of a random question, but this one's not too random as far as my questions go. What I want to know is, who is your tennis hero?
I am going to go for Gustavo Kuerten, which isn't an obvious choice for a Brit, but I wasn't an obvious tennis fan as a kid. I just remember him being, although I'd been watching tennis from much earlier, I was born in 85, so I was probably watching like Wimbledon from the early 90s. But when he won his first Roland Garros, I just remember that being incredibly exciting. I think it's probably one of the first times I watched Roland Garros as well, having, you know, being a typical Brit just watching the grass court season, and it kind of opening my eyes to this big world of tennis. And then, of course, he went on to win it two more times, and they were all very exciting. And he's the only tennis player I've ever taken a selfie with as well, because I was so excited to meet him. That was quite recently. That was only a couple of years ago at the O2.
And obviously we'll speak about everything that you've been up to in tennis, and I suppose taking selfies with other players isn't really part of the job for you. So, yeah, we'll talk about all that. I was born in 85 as well, and I was very much the typical Brit, only watched Queens and Wimbledon. And, you know, obviously I'd heard of Guga Kuerten and seen him play at Wimbledon, although that isn't his best surface by a long shot. But I never watched Roland Garros really until probably the last 10 years, really. So yeah, good one. Right, so let's just have a little word between ourselves on Wimbledon. Obviously, two Brits speaking here, we talk about how Britons really only care about Wimbledon and Queens, and it's going to be neither of those this year. The All England Club obviously putting out a statement on Wednesday, although it was a non-secret, really. People have been reporting that since the weekend, that Wimbledon were going to cancel the championships in 2020. They're not going to try and hold it later in the year. They've obviously explained as to why that's never going to work, and we all can all understand that. It's very much a fair weather tournament with it being on the grass, and although they have that one indoor, cut two roofs now, they've decided to cancel it completely, and they're going to rearrange it, as it were, or just start the next 134th championships will be on the 28th of June in 2021. So obviously disappointed, Rob, but understandable. It didn't come as a massive shock, really, did it?
Yeah, it is a disappointment. But then, you know, everything that's been cancelled, you know, from a professional and a personal point of view, is a big disappointment so far this year. It has to be done. It's the right decision. It's the right decision to cancel rather than, you know, keeping any kind of false hope about trying to reschedule stuff for later on in the year. There's a bit of a grab going on between tournaments for some slots later in the year. And I think it's the absolute right decision. Just, you know, call it off next year, clean slate. And, you know, I think it should almost, you know, it might be too early to be saying this, and it's not beneficial for me to be saying this, but it might make sense to cancel the rest of the season sooner rather than later.
Well, the Olympics have gone ahead and made their decision as well. That was last week, which obviously has a massive effect on tennis players as well. This was meant to be the year of that, kind of the five majors. Federer, hopefully, it made no secret of the fact that he was kind of aiming for that little period in the summer where it was going to be Wimbledon and the Olympics, and I know Djokovic was mad keen on and kind of righting some wrongs in terms of winning Olympic gold, but that's been cancelled as well. And then, you know, you've mentioned, you know, just kind of almost flippantly there, possibly cancelling the rest of the season. I know you're due to actually, maybe you should tell the viewers kind of what you're due to do in the back end of the year and kind of tie that into the Olympics as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been working away from tennis for the last few months. Since last year, I've been working on a fixed term contract for UEFA, so it's the first like extended period of time I've not worked on any ATP or WTA events. For 10 years, and I was due to come back into the fold for the Asian swing, so would be starting on Beijing, which, you know, ironically, with China starting to kind of open up a bit again now, would be probably one of the more, I think, maybe one of the safer places to play a tournament at the moment. I think obviously every tournament has its own kind of vested interest in trying to get a tournament on. I just think for the overall picture of tennis, it's such a difficult thing to have some tournaments played in some parts of the year and some not, and what happens with rankings and all that other kind of thing. But it would make, you know, if the rest of the season is cancelled, it will make a significant dent to my work for the second part of the year, and also for the last part of the year, because I was meant to be working on some things from Beijing onwards. But who knows what's going to happen.
And that's, you know, goes fivefold or tenfold for all of the, you know, it's a massive machine, isn't it? The world tours, ITF, ATP, WTA, so many people involved in the tours, you know, going down to us as journalists as well. How can you see tennis recovering from this if they do kind of, let's say that they do cancel the season, or even if they don't, like the massive uncertainty that so many people's incomes are dependent on this. And I'm sure there's going to be kind of lots of almost retirements going by the wayside here, especially lower down you go. Can people survive this?
Yeah, well, yeah, this is a big thing, obviously, for everyone involved in tennis and from my point of view, from sports television. Lots of friends and colleagues of mine have had just their entire calendars cancelled, and they are, you know, they're freelancers, or they work as directors of their own limited companies, or they are sole traders. And these are people in Britain anyway that are kind of falling between the gaps of what's getting looked after by government furloughs and things like that. So that's a really tough time for them. I'd like I say, being under this contract at the moment, I'm incredibly lucky. Otherwise, I would be in that exact same position. And obviously for lower ranked players, this is a very worrying time, because, you know, these, you know, you don't have to look too far outside of even the top 50 on both tours to, you know, to realize how much taking even a couple of months out of the season would have a massive financial effect on players and everyone else who makes a tournament happen. You know, tournaments are gonna lose a lot of money. You know, especially the smaller tournaments, the 250s, which sometimes can be, you know, a bit volatile and difficult for them to even break even anyway, even as it is. So yeah, I don't know. Yes, retirements. I think you're right. We might see a fair few of those. In terms of logistically, I just think, you know, similarly to what I would say for a lot of sports, you just kind of, you wipe the slate clean and say, okay, next year, assuming everything is up back up and running by January, in terms of rankings and stuff, after everyone is on the points that they were on at the beginning of last year, and you kind of carry on from there. But it's a lot of headaches and a lot of serious worries for people who work in tennis, you know, journalism, photographers, people who work in television, all these people are freelancers. And if live sport is the only thing you work on, it's a dangerous time, worrying time.
Yeah. Well, let's move on from that situation and maybe park that kind of there and and let's talk about kind of the past, the rosier past, as it were. And I didn't really probably introduce you. You are a freelance science journalist. People have worked that out by now. Obviously, coming from the UK and being all over the world with the sport, maybe just give us a little bit of information of, you know, a lot of people will be interested into how you kind of get into that and maybe building towards that. You know, we do know it's going to be coming back. So I'm sure people will be interested in how you got your route into tennis and kind of where you came from, as it were. So spill the beans, Rob, like what happened?
I started my career in sports television at the BT Tower in London. This was before the days of BT Sport, but BT Tower hosted a small production company, sports production company called CSI Sports. And it was at that point, it was kind of a joint venture between BT and CSI Sports. Before that, they'd been known as Octagon, and they were based over in Chiswick, I think. And I kind of joined having in telly for a couple of years, and I was working in documentaries, and I got a interview to be like a kind of regular freelancer for BT CSI Sports, but it was mainly to be doing some football stuff at BT Vision, if you can remember that, as a digital platform. It was, I think, BT Vision was, yeah, BT's version of kind of Virgin Media. And it was doing a lot of research and a few shoots for things like classic matches and preview programs for live sport. And they had some kind of strange Premier League highlights thing that I was doing some research for. And then all of a sudden they won a tender for to make the ATP World Tour magazine show. Which at the time was called ATP World Tour Uncovered, or actually the first year I worked on it, and the first year BTCSI made it. Yeah, it was 2009. So I started working on that as an AP assistant producer. So writing scripts for features, you'd get given a topic for a feature. One of the other producers would come back from a shoot with lots of interviews, and you would kind of write around this interview. So I remember the first one I did was about Nicolas Almagro. In 2009, and yeah, you write the links for the voiceover guy who's still is Gabriel Clark on ATP Uncovered. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he does the voice, and then you sit with an editor and you put everything together. And I've worked on that show now for the last time I worked on it would have been January last year, on a freelance basis. For 3 years it was at BT, and then it went to a company called Clean Cut, who run by some friends of mine who were producers on that show. So yeah, on a freelance basis, been working on that show since 2009. And then through doing that, through working on that show, and at the end of BTCSI's contract with that program, that's when I started to make other contacts, having been on a couple of shoots for this, make other contacts at ATP Media, who is the ATP's broadcasting arm. And then I started working for them, I think, in 2011 as an assistant producer. So I would go to tournaments and I would be in the TV compound making highlights programs and what's called news feed packages, which is all the relevant highlights and interviews and footage from the day that's sent down in a kind of 10-15 minute package. That's all changed now, the way that's done. And after a couple of years of doing that, I was promoted, if you like, still as a freelancer, whilst doing lots of other work, to produce for them. And producing for them involved making a 52 minute highlight show for each Masters 1000 tournament. As well as doing all the preview interviews with the players, and doing post-match interviews with players. And then I would have to voice a daily highlights program and a tournament highlights program. And I'd been doing that up until I started at UEFA last year. And hopefully I'm going back to do that towards the end of this year, but coronavirus permitting, I guess. And then, you know, through working for ATP Media, I gained contacts at WTA, and I did some work on WTA, and did some work on a couple of Grand Slams. What started as kind of very much sitting in a edit suite and graduated to going on shoots and interviewing players and stuff. It's a very varied job depending on who you're working for.
And did you have any kind of qualifications and stuff when you walked into kind of the tower and stuff like that? Did you go to university, for instance? Did you?
Yes, I did go to university.
I mean, I already know this. We have mutual acquaintances who you went to university with. So, but obviously, just for the audience, basically.
I studied the same thing as a very good friend of yours, which was television, media studies and television production at the University of Huddersfield. And as great as those 3 years were, and as much as I enjoyed the course and the university, personally, I can't speak for other people who've done television production courses, but it didn't really give me much in the way of contacts or in the way of how to break into the industry. So although you kind of learnt some important skills, and I wish I'd learnt more, you know, continuous access to kind of edit suites and cameras and stuff, which I never really used because I had it in my head I wanted to be a producer or a director. And produce at that time, producers or directors don't do much of the technical stuff. Now you cannot get by as a producer without being able to do some editing or some camera work, or you know, you have to be able to do a lot of these things. So yes, I did. It made absolutely zero difference to me getting any work. It's the honest truth. I think a lot of people in television will say that. So obviously, as everyone always says, a very difficult industry to get into. There were some things that still kind of live with me from like university experience, but it's very much starting fresh.
Basically, a few hangovers and a few social things, probably more than anything else. Shout out to all the students out there who are currently on their television production degree or anything like that. It means
that sounds terrible. Please carry on studying hard, and use the facilities much better to your advantage than I ever did. That's for sure.
Right, so let's talk about some of the juicy stuff then. You've told us that you've working on these programs. You interviewed Nicolas Almagro as you did your first piece about Nicolas Almagro.
I have interviewed him, but yeah, not until much later. My first interview was with another Spaniard, Guillermo Garcia Lopez, at Eastbourne, and that was my first shoot for ATP Uncovered.
Have you spoken to then? You've spoken to everyone, right?
Yeah, everyone past and present. I would say there's a few on the kind of a few of the youngsters on the ATP side. I mean, actually, no, not on the WTA side that I haven't interviewed yet because I haven't worked on tennis for a while.
So I'm going to run down a few names here, and you tell me approximately how many times that you've interviewed this person. Right?
Okay.
Novak Djokovic.
I'd say he is the player I've interviewed more than anyone else. I would say that's probably about 200 times, but who knows?
Incredible scenes. Serena?
Not as many, because she doesn't do as many WTA tournaments and certainly doesn't at the moment. But I would say Serena probably about 20, 30 times.
Federer?
Lots. Not as much as Djokovic, because he obviously kind of plays fewer tournaments. I would say 100, 150.
Oh my word, right. What about my kind of, not my hero, well, maybe my hero, Andy Murray?
Yeah, lots. I mean, obviously, you know, not as much as I'd like to recently. Andy Murray, probably about 120, 150 times, similar to Federer, but one the time, and it's probably one of my best experiences doing an interview, was with him after he won the O2, and he just sealed year-end world number one, and it was just the end of that amazing run.
What a year that was.
And just that tournament, you know, that breaking the record, I think, for ATP, the duration of three set ATP matches in two consecutive matches against Raonic and Nishikori. And just coming back from the break, and then the final against Djokovic was a relative walk in the park in comparison. But he just, that season was incredible. And that was one of the best interviews I've done. And just, you know, everyone was, you know, usually we've kind of, it's a bit of a step back in the TV compound, and, you know, everything's kind of seen from a different, you don't get as emotionally invested, especially when you've been doing it for such a long time. But literally everyone, even people I work with who wouldn't claim to be that bothered about tennis, was excited. You know, that was a noisy TV compound when that happened.
So you said, obviously, start with Guillermo Garcia Lopez. You said that you've spoken to all these people loads of times. Like, is this kind of in the pre-tournament stage, in the media day, or is it, you know, during the tournament? Have you done on-court interviews? Like, what have you been kind of speaking to these people about? And has it been absolutely terrifying?
All of the above. Lots of post-match, lots of on-court, and that kind of has come about more in the last kind of few years. Yes, media day. So there's a media day 1 or 2 days before the main draw of the tournament starts, where the top seeds of that tournament get paraded for the media. And then, because I'm working, or usually working for the host broadcaster, or literally for the ATP or for the WTA, you kind of have the responsibility of asking questions for a lot of other broadcasters. So a lot of the time it has to be quite generic stuff. But then if you're doing stuff for your own purposes, so might do the odd feature on a player profile or something like that, so you can get a bit more creative. And then certainly more in recent years, as digital exposure and social media outputs have become much more important, you do a lot more things like kind of quizzes and games and stuff with them as well, so you can have a bit more fun with them doing that. And some off-court stuff with some, but again, with more kind of on the ATP Uncovered side for that. When you kind of get them away from a tournament situation, then, and you have a bit more time with them, then they can be a bit more laid back. You might get to know them a bit better and get some more interesting stuff with them. But yes, certainly all of those things you mentioned, and at times it's nerve-wracking. Sometimes everything happens so quickly that those media days can be such a whirlwind that you don't really have time for it to be nerve-wracking, or the exact opposite. So you can have they can all come at once, or a big group of them can come at once, and you're just literally doing one after the other, and you don't have time to catch breath. Or you can be waiting for ages and ages and ages, and I think actually the latter is probably worse, because you get too relaxed, and that's when you forget things. When if you've been waiting for 45 minutes or an hour or something, and then somebody turns up and you've forgotten what you're going to say, it's
absolutely. And you mentioned it's kind of, you kind of get to know them a little bit. Is there any, you know, kind of favorites that I don't want you to pick people out necessarily, but anyone who's been particularly responsive or is really good with the media that kind of maybe surprised some people? I don't know.
I think kind of everyone, although they've kind of seen it more now from his social media, but I think people a few years ago, it was so kind of down, you know, the public at large were a bit down on Andy Murray, you know, saying unfairly that he's boring or he's miserable. And he's literally the exact opposite of that. He always, you know, he's someone that if I'm writing questions, I'll always, you know, think a little bit harder for his, because I know that he's always going to give a really considered an interesting answer. There's some guys that are always really, really nice to me, and the guys always say hello to you outside of the tournament. So if you see them at the hotel or a restaurant or something, that's what you always remember. So like people like Grigor Dimitrov, always really nice to me, remembers my name, which is great. Marin Cilic, also, yeah, very nice guy. Who else? And then on the women's side, people have always been really nice to people like Petra Kvitova, who, and I know a lot of colleagues of mine will say the same thing, is just one of the nicest people you could ever hope to meet. Angie Kerber has always been really lovely to me as well. There aren't really any, you know, there's no real horror stories really.
Go on then, tell us about a mortifying experience or something that you kind of regretted.
The worst thing, and I think I slept after it was the very last interview of a day, and these can be long days on the tennis. If center court's got 7 matches, you know, 5-day matches and 2-night matches, and you're there from 10 a.m. you can be there from 10 a.m. until, you know, 1-2, sometimes even like 2:30 in the morning. And it was the last interview of the day. It was on court with Anna Ivanovic in Cincinnati. Most people had left the center court, and I was waiting for her to come over. Did the first question. She was answering the first question, and for some reason, probably because I was really, really tired, I'd just completely forgotten what the second question was, and just didn't say anything, and just stood there like an absolute idiot. And then she's kind of like gesturing to the WTA player liaison guy next to me, like, what's this guy's problem? And I had to basically kind of pretend that I can't remember, I had some kind of like shooting pain in my leg or something. Oh, sorry, start again. Luckily it wasn't live. And started again, but it was just like the contempt in her face for me. It's like, who is this guy? What is he doing? And I was standing there for about, you know, when kind of like 5 or 10 seconds can just seem like a lifetime. And I don't know what had happened. Like my mind had just gone, probably just like thinking about getting home and going to bed. And I'd just gone and just had nothing to say. And it was,
Sure, that's your worst nightmare, isn't kind of an interview. And it must feel like it's just gone on forever and ever and ever. Oh, mate, that's, yeah.
That was pretty bad. I mean, on a media day in Dubai once, we were doing that on the top of a roof, and just before the first interview started, I had a bird crap on me, on my shirt. So my the heroic cameraman I was working with, Brucey, managed to get rid of it, but obviously left a massive stain, and so got asked a lot about that. And it seems to be the open air preview interviews where the worst stuff happens. I got really badly sunburned once as well in Indian Wells, and waiting for the last one of the day was Federer, and him, the first thing he said to me was, "Oh, you look like a lobster." Well, that's nice, thank you.
Yeah, Federer, you can't say anything either.
Yeah, has it been exactly. He said it with a cheeky grin, and I'm not going to get annoyed at Federer.
No, of course not. Has there been anything particularly funny then? Obviously, that's quite funny to us, you getting sunburned and getting crapped on by a bird. But anything genuinely you remember as being a particular time?
My first interview with her. I think it was my second interview with Serena Williams, and again it was Cincinnati. It was a preview interview. This one was in a studio, and she, as you can imagine, has quite a lot of entourage come in with her, and so that's always that always makes for quite a tense situation, because when you've got a huge audience of people, like some of these studios are really small, so like if a player brings in lots of people with them, then it can get really cramped and hot, and you can kind of hear, like hear all this entourage breathing on you. But I was doing a sound check quite a last minute sound check with the, because I think she was the first one of the day with the cameraman. I said to the cameraman, "Oh, how am I sounding?" And she said, "This is as she sat in front of me. We're about to do the first question." She said to me, "Oh, you're sounding really sexy. I'm really digging that." And I think, yeah, obviously she wasn't. She was taking the mic, and she wasn't being genuine. But I also think there was part of it, you know, she was trying, because she didn't know, you know, I'd not interviewed her before. I think it might have been like a little bit of a kind of initiation thing. And luckily I was able to kind of respond quite quickly. And I said, "Oh, it doesn't, it might not surprise you to know that that nobody's ever really said that to me before." And she had this incredible, maybe slightly staged, but you know, quite satisfying laughing fit. Seemed to last for about a minute. And you know, all her entourage were laughing as well. I was like, "Oh, good, okay, this will get her in a really good mood for a preview interview." it was quite a standard one. It was all right. Lucky the cameraman was rolling for all of that, so that's something I like to break out to bore people with regularly.
That's how you met your good missus, and it regaled her with that story, and then had the proof to back it up. You must have kind of some tournaments that you like to go to, some that you don't, and kind of let's talk about some of those. Seems we haven't got any to watch. Like, which tournaments do you think are the best to be at for you?
I love Indian Wells, and I think everyone, you know, everyone that I've ever worked with would probably say the same thing. I think most people would have that as their top tournament. Obviously, the weather is great, the setting is beautiful. It's a really, really well run tournament. The players are all always in a really good mood. It's just great. There's some really great places to eat and drink nearby, you know, which is important when you're there for a long period of time. I've seen some amazing tennis there. The atmosphere on that centre court is great, especially for night matches. It was the first Masters I ever worked on, and it was, yeah, it's always really great fun. I haven't been there for a couple of years. Obviously, I haven't been there this year, and I wasn't there last year. But before that, it was the only one I'd continually done.
What about Asia?
Yes, well, Tokyo is amazing. Because it's Tokyo, and that city is incredible. I really, of the Chinese ones, I enjoyed Beijing a lot more than Shanghai. Although, there's none I really, really dislike. There's none I kind of don't look forward to going to. Monte Carlo is the one event of the Masters where there's no night sessions, and that makes a big difference for us, obviously, because it means the days aren't so long. But then it's probably
that means that you're high rolling in the casinos for the night, right?
So that's exactly my point. It's not the place that I want to be spending evenings off, really, because, you know, it doesn't have, not being a high roller, Monte Carlo doesn't have much to offer for me in the evenings. So, you know, there's a few good affordable restaurants, and if you go nearby, you know, if you've been doing it for years, then you kind of learn places nearby. We would go to Nice quite a bit as well. Having evenings off in any of the other tournaments would be great. Maybe for that reason, Monte Carlo I don't enjoy as much as the others. But I mean, that's a stupid thing to say, because, you know, the days are shorter, so that's good.
Yeah. Have you ever run into any players kind of on nights out, or kind of off grid? Is it?
So it depends. Like, when you're doing kind of tournaments that are in smaller places, if you like, or like don't have a lot kind of nearby, so when you're somewhere like Montreal, for example, is right in the heart of the city, and it's a big city, so there's lots of stuff to choose to do. Indian Wells, less so. You know, you have to travel for a long way to get to Palm Springs, so everyone goes to similar places, so you'll quite often see players and coaches in restaurants, sometimes in bars if it's later on in the week. Obviously places like Monte Carlo because it's smaller and everyone's got the evenings off. Yeah, you'll see them around a lot. Cincinnati, because it's in a town outside of Cincinnati called Mason, Ohio. And that's quite a small place. And there's like a handful of places that people want to go out and eat to. So, you'll see a lot of players and stuff there. This has never happened to me, but a friend of my colleague of mine once had his and the rest of his friends' dinner paid for by Jamie Murray, I think it was, who was sat on the table next to them. So that was very nice. That's never happened to me. The most in terms of gratuities, I think, was Del Potro with some friends, and he gave me a beer from his big bucket of Corona that him and his mates had bought. So that's the most exciting freebie I've ever had from a player, if you like.
I think a lot of people listening to this would kill for a Corona from Del Po's little stash.
Free. I'm all about the free stuff. Yeah, that's another great thing about working on the tennis. You can get a lot of free merch sometimes. Although, yeah, again, I think that happened kind of less after I started working on it. Unfortunately, I heard stories that at Shanghai, you used to get to your hotel room and the tournament would have left a big hold all full of tennis equipment. Nice. Not rackets or anything, but like clothes and stuff. So that's cool. Yeah, I've got a few Indian Wells jackets and caps and things like that.
I was going to say, you're up to your eyeballs in caps, basically, I would imagine. Other than getting free stuff, what about tennis would you change if you kind of had the chance, if you were in a bit more of a position of power than we are as journalists?
I think, well, it's actually some of the things that they're implementing in the anything that kind of that speeds it up slightly but doesn't take away too much of the excitement. And just not scheduling, I would change slightly as well. Like, at dual tournaments, I kind of get it, whereby you would have like seven matches on a centre court if you've got men's and women's tournaments to get through. Tournaments where it's just the men or just the women, where the matches are kind of staggered throughout the day to have a day session, a night session. I get that the tournaments want to make money from selling day session and night session tickets, but I would trim everything down in terms of scheduling.
And would you recommend what you're doing as a career, freelance journalism, getting into tennis? Have you enjoyed what you've been doing? Would you recommend it to other people?
Absolutely. Oh, well, I'm incredibly lucky. And, whenever I get a bit kind of jaded with working in TV, or whenever anyone around me is, I have to kind of, just take a step back and a bit of a reality check and say, if I'd have gone back to the 14-year-old me and said, in 20 years, you're going to be interviewing tennis players and making television programs, I'd have been incredibly excited. So I do try and channel some of that kind of excitement from when I was much younger and try and remember that when I'm having a bad day. Yes, I would definitely recommend it. If you love tennis, I'm very lucky that my two favorite sports are tennis and football, and those are the two sports I work on the most, easily by a long way.
Yeah, lucky you're good, maybe, who knows. If you were to give one piece of advice then to someone, say, who was that 14-year-old who watches tennis, loves tennis, like wants to kind of build the self up into doing something like you're doing, what would you say to that 14-year-old?
Well, the important thing now is social media engagement, isn't it? Because I think that, that's kind of how, if you can make your own stuff, shoot your own stuff, do your own podcasts, or write your own articles, get things out there. Obviously, it's a much more flooded market. It's more egalitarian now, which is great in terms of, you know, anyone can, not anyone, most people can kind of upload something to YouTube and kind of push something on Twitter. Whereas before, you know, doors were very kind of closed. You had to know people in certain businesses. But then the flip side to that is everyone's doing it. So, you know, if you're creative and you've got a new idea, a new spin on a tennis web program or something, then that's the way to get noticed, I think.
Come and work for Last Word on Tennis.
That's absolutely.
Get writing, just get going, and you never know, like I say, where it could take you. You've been to a lot of the big tournaments you mentioned, obviously Indian Wells. I think you've done. Have you done Grand Slams as well?
I have. Yeah, not all of them. I've not done the Australian Open. In fact, I've never been to Australia, so that is very, very high up on my list.
So that maybe answers the question. Like I was going to ask, is there anything left in tennis that you've yet to achieve that kind of drives you on and inspires you? I presume you think, you know, you want to get back into the tennis after your contract's finished with UEFA, and there's got to be something that's driving you.
I would, if I can work on the Australian Open next year, that would be incredible. But speaking of long days, from what I've heard, those are the longest days. But, yeah. You know, I'm willing to do whatever it takes to work on that tournament. I'm really lucky that I've been able to, you know, work on pretty much every tournament I want to work on. Oh, how could I forget this? Acapulco. And if there's anyone from WTA or ATP Media listening to this, please hire me for Acapulco on site next year. I say this every year, and it hasn't happened yet. But I'm holding out hope. It just looks amazing. And I've worked on it from the other side. So, you know, I've worked for the ACP 500s. The crew's kind of split into two, with a producer and a cameraman out on site, and a producer and an editor back in Stockley Park, making the live shows and the highlight shows. And so I've been on that side of it. So doing overnight. overnight edits.
That doesn't sound as fun.
No, you're talking on talkback to the producer who's out there, and you know they might be complaining about something really trivial, and you're thinking, mate, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm in a windowless room in Hayes, and you are in Acapulco. You know,
shout out to Hayes, all the people of Hayes there. It's a lovely place, really. Have you worked at Haller?
Yes, and I love it.
Right. You might be in a good position then for the quiz question that I'm going to fire at you.
Oh, okay, great. I've only done Haller once, but it's definitely one of my favourite tournaments. So I love Germany anyway. I speak a bit of German, so that kind of helps. But yes, Haller's great, and we shot an amazing feature with some Federer super fans there, which was really good fun. We really enjoyed that. So I've got great memories of that tournament.
Well, does Federer play there? I never really noticed. Right. let's move into the quiz questions then. You said you're going to be very competitive about this. I have got you an interesting question. It's actually in two parts. So we're going to go for the first part first, obviously. I'm looking for you to tell me any player who has won at Haller, has won at Queen's, and has won Wimbledon. Okay, so to have completed the what I would like to call the grass court trilogy, which I don't think anybody else is calling it. So a player that has won at Haller, has won at Queen's, and has won Wimbledon. There are two people who have done it.
Really? Wow. Okay. This is. I think you might have.
Haller has been going since 1993. That's probably given.
I think you might have caught me out early doors here. Now that's right. So going back to think of players that have won at Queen's. Oh, I know who's done it. And I might even be able to tell you the years. So Leighton Hewitt won Wimbledon in 2002, won Haller in 2009, I think. Like, but that was one of the last tournaments he won. And he's definitely won like three times, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Leighton Hewitt is correct. Well done. So you don't go blank.
And then the other one.
The other one is obviously going back a bit. So I said it started in 93. He won it in 90. He won Hallett in 94.
Yeah. Can I guess that this might be? Well, I don't think he's won Queens though. Richard Krajicek.
It's not Krajicek. You would be able to speak to this person in their mother tongue.
Right. Okay then. Well. Oh, do you know what? I'm not going to go for the obvious. I'm going to say it's Michael Stich.
It is Michael Stich.
Very good. His mother tongue as well. Yeah, he's a nice guy. He was the tournament director of Hamburg until recently. Yeah, nice guy.
Yeah, he won Queens in 93 and obviously Wimbledon. Yeah. 92 that he won Wimbledon. It was around that time anyway, obviously. So, very good.
I think 91.
Yeah. Sticking to Halle, the second part of your question is. Can you tell me who has won Halle in the 2000s whose name has not been Roger Federer?
Have I just said it? Was it Leighton Hewitt?
Well, you've got Leighton Hewitt, yeah. And then there are eight others.
Eight others in the 2000s?
Yeah.
Houses, okay. Wow, this is going to be tough. Philip Kohlschreiber, I think that might be afterwards, though.
Kohlschreiber's correct.
Paul Schreiber, Tommy Haas.
Correct.
How many did you say? There was eight.
I should have said since 2000, to be honest. Since 2000. So we're talking all the way up to modern day. So if you can remember.
Okay. That makes it a bit easier. Borna Coric.
Yeah.
Sasha Zverev?
Not Sasha Zverev. He's made it to two finals.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I'm going to start giving you some clues. We've got a German who won it in 2016, who beat Zverev. And then you have to go a bit further back to people you had not got. So we've got a Czech who won it in 2007. We've got a Russian who won it in 2002, a Swede who won it in 2001, and another German in 2000, which if anyone listening at home gets the German from 2000, then you get the primo recognition for that. Because that would be a tough one to get.
Is the Swede Jonas Björkman?
It's not. It's a Swedish Grand Slam champion. The last Swedish Grand Slam. Thomas Johansson, yeah. The Russian's also a Grand Slam champion. He won won Halle three times.
And he's a Grand Slam champion. 2002. Marat Safin.
Not Safin.
So Kafelnikov then.
Kafelnikov, yeah.
Wow, I'm doing terribly here. The German in 2016 is a really annoying one because I know that I was working again at Stockley Park on Queens and the people across the way were doing Halle. Oh, who was it? Who are the other Germans now? That's the stupid thing. You're going to have to tell me because my mind's gone completely blank now. Well, you said there was Australia.
I'm going to go back to 2000. So David Prinsel was 2000. Thomas Berdych was a Czech player from 2007. Yeah. And the German from 2016 was Florian Mayer.
Of course it was.
I think you beat Federer.
Oh, that's really annoying. Never mind.
Florian Mayer. Great grass court player.
Yeah, I think that was the only thing he was good at. He has a less than 50% winning record on the ATP Tour, Florian Mayer. But, you know, he's won ITP titles. So
he was Wimbledon quarter finalist as well, wasn't he, 1 year? But he had a really exaggerated backswing and, very unorthodox. And I love players like that.
Still won over $7 million US dollars, so I can't be too harsh on the guy.
Yeah, so. he won a few tournaments. Did he win? He got to Hamburg final 1 year. I know because he lost to the other Leonardo Mayer. I think that might have been the same year that he won Halle actually.
Because his last win was before Halle was in 2011, and he hadn't made a final. since that one used the Romanian Open on clay, funnily enough. Right, that's enough Florian Mayer chat for one podcast. Rob, thank you so much for kind of getting involved and speaking with me here. I'm sure a lot of people listening would have really enjoyed all the kind of stories that you've got from your inside information. If you guys, that's my fire alarm going off, ladies and gentlemen, because we're cooking bacon. If anyone's interested, bacon sandwiches.
I am.
And I'm really hungry, so I'm going to sign off on that. Thank you again, Rob.
Thank you, Andy. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm sure I'd like to have you on for something else. We've got something in the pipeline. So everyone who enjoys the podcast listening, I've got a really interesting debate podcast coming up in the next couple of weeks, and I'll tease that out over the next couple of weeks. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and stay in touch with the website, and hopefully we'll see you again soon, Rob.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye.
Clouds are forming all around. Take your time, fill it up. Drinking gin from a paper cup. We've got all of